You're listening to a Least Important Things miniseries.
Dear listener, your mission, if you choose to accept it, is to rewatch every Mission Impossible movie with Luke Ferris and Mike Wynn. Together, you'll investigate everything from Tom Cruise's running stride to the legacy of this spy action franchise. Good luck. This podcast will self-destruct in 30 seconds.
Welcome to Podcast Impossible, a special rewatch miniseries from Least Important Things, where we accept the mission of watching every Mission Impossible movie leading up to the seventh installment in the series. Our task is to investigate the improbable influence of this franchise on culture, cinema, and Tom Cruise's legacy. With me, of course, is my Luther to my Ethan, my good friend Mike Wynn. Hello, Mike. He's doing research. He cannot be bothered. He's back. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm ready to be here.
Ready for Mission Impossible 3. And Mike, we can't have a third movie without having a third person in this conversation. That's why I'm proud to announce the winner of this year's Academy. Oh wait, no, sorry, wrong show. I'm proud to announce and include the winner of the historic Jurassic Pod Fantasy Draft and friend of the show, Jim Hargrove. Welcome back to the madness.
Thank you. I would like to be introduced like that every time we talk going forward.
I think you deserve it.
That's important. Also, if you guys are Luther and Ethan, can I be Benji? Because
yes, you can be Benji. We already, it's funny because we gave our last guest, Zach Hall, Benji, because we didn't feel like Mission Impossible 2 had an appropriate sidekick. And yeah, I had fair. Called Mike Luther, but I think we can have two Benjis.
See, well, this is the introduction of Benji.
So it really is fitting.
Episode 3.
So you are definitely the Benji.
I think Zach's probably better off as Ambrose anyway. Right?
Yeah, I think Zach is Ambrose. Shout out Zach Hall for the Mission Impossible 2 episode. If you missed that delight where we got into it about all things that you expected in a Mission Impossible podcast, including SD cards and the like. But we will do none of that nonsense. It is a straight-laced episode today because we're talking about Mission Impossible 3. I'm going to dive into some Mission Impossible facts and figures. But first, Jim, before we get into the conversation, what's your journey with Mission Impossible? What is your experience with the franchise?
I've seen them all. I enjoy them all. I think the third one is really where my interest took off. Like, I remember seeing the first one, the second one, and being like, yeah, it's kind of cool, kind of a ripoff of James Bond, kind of like trying to do its own thing, but not quite. But then the third one, I remember like it takes kind of the next step, I think, in the franchise. And then from there, it's like each one builds and gets more intense. So like this third one really was a taking off point for me, to the point where like Fallout, I've seen, I don't know how many times. If I see it on as a streamable platform, I will stop.
You're watching it.
Like I just, any of the newer, anyone from 3 to Fallout, what is that? 6?
Yeah.
7. And to 6, I will watch. And I think they're great. So I'm a big fan.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that because this is very much a tonal shift of the franchise. Yeah. Some big shifts from 2 to 3. So 3 is interesting because if you listen to our podcast, Jurassic Pod, you will know that we talked about Jurassic Park 3 as a movie that connected with us because of the time it came out, our ages. I feel like because we're all the same age, for me at least, Mission Impossible 3 came out at a very specific era where I was going to movies. I was like in the demographic of like seeing a PG-13 action movie was a big deal.
And yeah,
I was
excited. You were about 12 years old.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when,
like middle school.
Yeah.
Yeah. What year did this come out?
2006. We'll get into the facts and figures, but I feel like this was very spot on middle school. Like I just remember this movie so well.
I do feel like that's one of your, like that's in the pocket of formative years for anything really. but especially media. And so I feel like, Mission Impossible 3 in that 2006 timeframe really did come out at a time when the three of us were really being impressed upon by movies.
And this movie was shown on FX and other like, traditional television channel, like TV films. This was shown for like 4 years. Do you remember the show? Straight.
I don't remember if it was FX or not, but there used to be a show, Dinner and a Movie.
And Mike,
it was a cooking show.
It's funny that you bring this up. We're already off track, by the way, but that's okay. Listeners, you know you're in for the long haul when you're with us.
Yeah.
Dinner and the Movie, if you would ask me what my dream job would be, being the host of Dinner and the Movie is still, to this day, my dream job. It is the cross-section of everything that I love. Food, people, conversation, and movies, and short, interstitial, basic cable television programs. It is the greatest thing that has ever been made.
Is there a podcast titled Dinner and a Movie?
Dude, this might be a tease because I actually have a Least Important Things essay style idea. I want to do a full deep dive on Dinner and a Movie. I want to know who created it. So that's just a tease. Anyways, sorry, Mike. You said the magic words. Dinner and a Movie. Well, let's get into it, guys, before I start talking about Dinner and a Movie even further. Are you ready for some facts and figures and fun information about Mission Impossible 3? Here we go. Mission Impossible 3, as we said, opened May 5th, 2006. That weekend, gentlemen, you could have seen movies like RV, United 93, and Aquila and the Bee. Later that month, you could have seen The Da Vinci Code and X-Men 3, The Last Stand, both movies that I saw in the theaters. So really interesting time to come out with movies, some huge blockbusters, big hitters coming out in May that Mission Impossible 3 had to compete with.
If I had to guess, it probably had to take that first weekend box office, but that second weekend probably fell behind pretty quick.
It did fall behind. By the end of May, it was sitting right there in third. It would gross over $398 million, just short of $400 million. Which is actually much less than the second film. Now, we've talked about this on Jurassic Pod. There's a thing that happens with finances in movies. The actual total budget or how much you make of a movie, a lot of times in franchises, depends on what happened in the last movie. So Mission Impossible 1, very popular movie, did well. Mission Impossible 2 did really well at the box office because of the hype of Mission Impossible 1. Mission Impossible 2, not well received as much as the first one. Mission Impossible 3, of course, wouldn't do as well. Because this took a long time to get made, even longer than the gap between the first and second. So a lot of people needed to come back to the franchise. It cost $150 million to make and was shot on location in China, Italy, Germany, Virginia, and California. And here's the team. I call this the official launch of the cinematic Abramsverse. It was directed by J.J. Abrams in his directorial debut. If you didn't know who J.J. Abrams was or is, he would go on to make Star Trek, Star Wars, tons of stuff. But at that time, as this movie was coming out, he was a TV guy. He was known for Alias, one of my favorite shows of all time, Felicity, and Lost. So really popular TV guy, but this is his first time in the saddle doing a big directorial film. Cinematography was by Dan Mindell, who worked with Abrams, but he did Spy Game and Enemy of the State, two really good spy movies. Edited by Marion Brandon and Mary Jo Marquet, both editors on Alias. Michael, are you ready for this one? Music by our good friend Michael Giannaccio, who would go on to do the Jurassic World franchise and so many things. But at that time, he had only done The Lost. He was kind of a hot commodity at this point because he had done The Lost music and The Incredibles, but he was still pretty young, like a lot of these people who worked on this film. Of course, J.J. Abrams, he's a writer, director, producer. He helped write this film alongside the duo Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman, who wrote on Alias, and they both eventually created the show Fringe, the cult Fox show Fringe, and then also helped with a lot of Abrams projects in the future, Star Trek, etc. The film stars, of course, Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt, Philip Seymour Hoffman as Owen. Is it Davin or it's Davin, right?
Davian.
Davian. I just, so it's just Philip Seymour Hoffman for me. Ving Rhames comes back as Luther, Billy Crudup as Musgraves, Michelle Moynihan as Julia, John Rhys as Myers Declan, Kerry Russell as Lindsay Ferris with an A, not related, no relation. Maggie Q as Zen, Simon Pegg as Benji, and Larry Fishburne as Theodore Brassel. So pretty star-studded cast from top to bottom. They're really bringing in the talent. Some interesting fun facts that you can fact check. I'm not going to do the work for you. This was really Cruise fully on his stunt game. In the previous film, we talked about it. Him and John Woo kind of battled a little bit about doing his own stunts, et cetera. We'll talk about it later. He did his own stunts like fully throughout this film. With a budget of $150 million, this was the most expensive movie ever undertaken by a first-time director. This was not going to be J.J. Abrams' project. It was originally supposed to go to a director named Joe Carnahan, who did Smoke and Aces the same year. He also did Cop Shop, more of an indie action director. So he had the job for about 7 months, and there's a YouTube video of him talking about it, and we'll put it in our show notes. It seems like he got the job. There was excitement about it, but he's an indie guy. I think he was not suited to handle this big of a franchise. I think his ideas were too off the wall a bit, and he quit before he got fired, essentially what it sounds like, from his words.
Did you mention Hoffman was coming off of Capote for this one?
No, I didn't, but that's a great point.
He had just won the Academy Award for Capote, which was done in 2005. And Hoffman was kind of like the hottest actor in Hollywood. He was nominated for an acting Academy Award in 2005, 8, 9, and 13.
Right at his like pinnacle, which is amazing that he did this film. It's kind of a surprise based on his other projects. Like you wouldn't have expected. What else do I have? David Fincher was rumored to direct this as well, but dropped out. The storyline was going to be working with black market trade of body parts in Africa. So yeah, a little bit different tone if you had David Fincher at the helm. The outdoor scenes at the end of the movie with the running, which we'll talk about in China, was actually shot on location, and they used actual residents of that area. So actually local Chinese folks that were just played extras, and they had to get a bilingual crew to help basically bark orders across those huge kind of, I don't know if you call them, they're not flotillas, but those like waterway kind of Venice style housing. It's just so gorgeous. And then another surprise potential role, Rachel McAdams turned down the role that eventually went to Michelle Moynihan. So, which I think could have worked, but Michelle Moynihan was great. So that is the interesting facts that you can fact check, but we will move on. Gentlemen, any of those facts stand out to you? Or just thoughts on, as before we dive into the plot points.
Funny, if they stuck with their original director, Mission Impossible wouldn't be Mission Impossible, probably. Probably would have been the last one, potentially. Maybe would have fallen flat. Now it's going to be, could be the biggest movie of this calendar year. You know, the franchises continue, and the one that comes out this year is just massive. So it's kind of funny what could have been if you look at, if they had made certain personnel choices and stuck with them.
It's fascinating, like what you think about, like what could have been the alternative timelines, like you said, Jim. And if you think, if J.J. Abrams didn't do this, he was going to get an opportunity. Like J.J. Abrams, he's a protege of Steven Spielberg. He was already a really well-known guy in Hollywood. He was going to get an opportunity no matter what. But I think this accelerated his rise to be one of the most influential people in the film industry, because he did a fantastic job, and a lot of people said resurrected or saved this franchise. I don't know if it save is the right word, but I think he brought a new tone and quality to this franchise. Like you said, Jim, that really helped set up. And this is really, I think this is the foundation of the franchise that we know today, starts with this film, and a lot of the elements that continue on even the fun stuff, that even some of the like funny tropes start with this film. And it would have been really interesting if Abrams wasn't a part of it, but he definitely, I'm going to just be honest. I love this movie. This is actually like one of my, it might be my favorite Mission Impossible movie and one of my top like favorite action movies in the last 25 years. I absolutely love it. So I'm really biased. So sorry, it's going to happen.
I agree. I think it's up there for best Mission Impossible. Unfortunately, the competition is fierce for that award.
It's going to be interesting because I was trying to think about that because I'm a huge Alias fan. I will name drop Alias probably 20 more times. And this movie is like, if they actually made an Alias movie, there's so many like themes that they took from that. And obviously everyone working on it worked on Alias, but I was thinking through this that if it had like one, there were some good action pieces, but if they had what we now know, like action pieces, if you put one of those in this one, I think it would be the best. I think it's missing that wow factor that either through technology or ability or just not having McQuarrie in the director's chair and budget probably that the sequential movies have. It just doesn't have that like jaw drop. Like, I can't believe they did that moment. That's the only thing it's missing.
Yeah. This one to me is, it used to be my favorite until Fallout came out. Like, I think this one's even better than Rogue Nation and I forget what the fourth one's called. I think it's surprisingly the most realistic of them all. Like, there's nothing that's like completely outlandish. Well, there's one scene that we can talk about later that bothered me, but everything else is like, it's more or less realistic. It's not, you know, you don't see Tom Cruise hanging out of an airplane like you do in the most recent one. You don't see him climbing the big building in Abu Dhabi. Like, you don't see anything completely outrageous in this. And I think I like that. I think it's nice that it's like seemingly realistic for some secret agent somewhere to potentially be doing stuff like this. You know,
it's a very tight film. Every line of dialogue relates to something that happens later in the movie. There's not a lot of fluff in this movie, which I really appreciate. Especially in Mission Impossible 2, where there's a lot of fluff in there, and just big action movies and franchises in general, it's nice to not have to have a lot of exposition, and we'll get into it. So let's just get into it. The movie opens up. This is exactly how, if you watch the pilot of Alias, this is exactly how the pilot of Alias starts. You have a torture sequence that opens up that you eventually go back to at the end of the episode. It's really fun storytelling, and it just jumps you into the tension right away, especially when you have Philip Seymour Hoffman. I mean, you're like, okay, this is different.
I think that's the key here, because in a lot of ways, I think Philip Seymour Hoffman carries this movie.
And
some may say that's sacrilege. What are you talking about? Tom Cruise is Ethan Hunt in this movie, but Seymour Hoffman is so good in this movie. And I think that it was strategic by Abrams to edit the movie that way, to put Hoffman right at the front of it. This is the guy who is driving all the conflict. He's the one carrying the movie. He is the best actor in the movie. And I loved it.
If you take that scene, so obviously that scene occurs again later in the movie. If you only look at the scenes of Philip Seymour Hoffman before that, I don't think you think he's as bad of a guy. Like, you see that scene at the start and how heartless he is and how like, you're not going to get the better of me and I'm going to do this. Like, he sets himself up as just a bad, bad guy right from the start. And every scene after that, you know, you kind of think back to the first scene and like, oh, this guy is a bad dude. He's not just kind of some not unemotional, you know, arms dealer. He's like, he's a bad dude. Because you don't see anything, you don't really see him do anything bad until that scene happens again. But seeing that scene first really sets what you know about that person really, really well.
And I like that it's so harsh, but not dramatic. And I think Jim, you mentioned that this one feels like a really grounded story because I'm not going to say I secretly am a spy and know what arms dealers and people who work in the underworld are like, but I'm assuming they're very cutthroat, horrible, nasty people that aren't necessarily trying to bring attention to themselves. Like, that's his kind of whole bit. That, like, he's proud that he's never been found. To me, that makes sense. Like, I love James Bond, but, like, the Bond villains want to be known. Like, they're Elon Musk's. Like, they want the attention. Like, to me, he's someone who's just like, I'm not messing around. Like, I'll do what it takes. Like, I have no empathy for anything. I'm just results. It's shocking, especially compared to other action movies.
I also think what helps the cold open and sets up the next scene where we see Ethan as a family man is how vulnerable he is in the cold open. You actually see him like actually desperate, as opposed to like just playing a con or playing the agent. And it's just so, I think Cruz does a great job of acting it and just like showing that, yeah, Ethan Hunt is cold blooded, but like what happens when Ethan is really like has no options, has no plays at all.
And it's so different than Mission Impossible 2, where the love story is so forced. It's so cheesy. And you don't really believe Ethan cares about the character, the woman. Like, Ethan, you're like, I don't really see, but this, because like you said, Mike, bam, we go from that emotional scene. We do have the old school title sequence where it's just the lighting the match and the fuse. And then we go into, I think, one of the best engagement parties you could go to. I mean, that looked fantastic. I was like, I want to be there. It looks incredible. And then we get the classic Greg Grunberg cameo. I don't know if you noticed that he's the character that is asking what Ethan does. He works at the Department of Transportation. Greg is one of J.J. Abrams' best friends. He had a starring role in Alias, but he has been in every single Abrams project.
Is this an Alias podcast, or is this a Mission Impossible podcast?
This is an Alias podcast. This is an Alias podcast.
I need you going forward to start a tally. Every time Luke mentions Alias,
do you have a ringer?
For every other episode of this podcast, all the way to the end.
He's mentioned Alias. It four Alias. Times, so I have four tallies.
Okay.
At least four.
Well, he is in Alias, but he is also in five. All of J. Jim's projects.
I think a bigger deal than the cameo you're mentioning is the cameo of Jesse from Breaking Bad.
Oh, yes. I was going to get to that, where he plays. So he plays Michelle Moynihan's younger brother. When I was watching,
is that him or is it the guy from Shameless?
No, that's the.
Is it Jesse Pinkman?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's it from Breaking Bad. Because at first I was like, he's in this movie, and then I was like, oh, okay, so that's it. It was just one line, and then he comes back later when he's on the phone to Ethan, and I remember that joke, and I remember that specifically watching it the last time I watched it. Or when I at first watched it, because that's one of the bits of the movie that he's like, oh, no, man, like, sorry for eating your food. But at the time, obviously, he wasn't a star. But now looking back on it, it's hilarious when you have those kind of cameos.
I mean, wasn't Malcolm in the Middle out at that point? Wasn't he in Malcolm in the Middle at that time?
No, he's the opposite character. He's not. He's the young guy in Breaking Bad. He was not in Malcolm.
You're right. I'm thinking of something totally different.
Are you thinking of Bryan Cranston?
Bryan Cranston.
No. I wasn't thinking of Bryan Cranston. Was not I'm thinking in this of. Movie. I'm thinking of a different character. Okay, but I'm on this wavelength. I just made a mistake here.
Bryan Cranston should be in a Mission Impossible movie. He'd be a perfect IMF guy. He would be really good.
He would be a good like paper pusher. Yeah, I feel.
I would really like it. So at the party, things are going great. He's impressing everybody. This is one of the first instances where I just was like, this movie, it's so tight. The writing is so good because Ethan, obviously spy, he's watching his fiance talk to her girlfriends and he can read their lips. And then he jumps in and answers the question of, this is the lake that we went to. It's a very funny moment. It's very much Mr. and Mrs. Smith. What if spies were living in a suburban neighborhood? It's also I'm sure we've all been there. We're all men that have been married for a substantial amount of time. We've been in scenarios where you're at an engagement party or you're at a party and your wife's talking to their friends and you're like, I wonder if they're talking about me. Like, you hear the giggling in the background. You're like, they probably are talking about me. I wish I knew what they said, or maybe I don't want to know. I feel like maybe I'm just speaking for myself.
Well, for me, it's like, of course they're talking about me.
Of course. What else would they have to talk about?
What else would they talk about?
I'm sure James feels the same way.
See, Lindsay's always a dead giveaway because she'll like start looking at me out the corner of her eye. So I know.
You don't even need
to. I'm even trying to hide it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just know. Yeah.
So Ethan talks about, he's like, this is just so Tom Cruise. This is not like a characteristic of Ethan Hunt as a character. This is a characteristic of Tom Cruise as a character. Okay. So Tom Cruise is actually just describing what his brother-in-law does in real life, which is model traffic patterns. And he's like, just, you know, like he somehow got people like super wired into like what traffic patterns are. Yeah, like
if you hit the bumper, it just changes the whole system. It's amazing that someone like that could be part of an organization that convinces people to give away lots of money.
Yep.
Yeah. Scientology. Moving on. So another alias rule is, write it down. Another alias rule is that if you are happy as our lead character, that means something bad will happen. It's just bound to happen. Ethan gets a call from something that doesn't really happen anymore, where you can get called by a telemarketer that you've won a trip or a condo vacation, which, as we know, is IMF. He goes to get ice, quote unquote, and then we meet our. I wouldn't say foil, but we meet the character that will, spoiler alert, betray Ethan, Musgrave, played by Billy Crudup, who, if you don't know, he's in a lot of things, but probably best known from The Watchmen. But I really like him as an actor. He's a great character actor, perfect for this role. And they talk about, you can tell they're buddies, but they kind of talk about, oh, Ethan, you know, you're not in the field, you're a trainer. So then we learn that Ethan's actually training IMF agents. And we get to understand that Ethan's definitely done with the IMF thing. Like, he's taking a break. He's not climbing rock cliffs, free soloing rock cliffs for fun anymore. He's domesticated. You know, he's got his shed. He's got his shed with a bikes and a canoe, but he's very much retired. But I don't think that's going to stay the same for very long. But I like domesticated Ethan. I could watch a lot of domesticated Ethan. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm interested to hear more about traffic patterns and how they're modeled. And I do like coming out of Mission Impossible 2. First of all, there is discontinuity between the movies because he leaves the first movie like with this girl. Or I'm sorry, the second movie with this girl that he's no longer with. Now he's engaged to another woman. And I think I think there's discontinuity there because you start asking questions of why he's not connected to this like thief and like
Thandi Newton's character.
Thandi Newton, yeah.
Yeah.
And like, Thandi.
Which she was asked to come back and she said no. To no surprise.
Well, for good reason. Well, that was when she thought John Woo was going to be the director. I'm just kidding. So I do think that there's an interesting like psychology here. Ethan is really trying to distance himself from the world saving, and I think that that's why you could read between the lines here and say, okay, he doesn't want to date somebody that's in the industry. Let's say
right, like a thief.
Right, or knows him as the world saver. So I appreciate that to a certain extent. But yeah, domestic Ethan. I wonder, like, what kind of Pinewood Derby car does domestic Ethan make?
Very high quality. He does. So Ethan is – they could have probably added about two more jokes in that dinner party. I'm talking both sides of my mouth here because – I love the tightness of this movie and that it's like every line adds value, but it would have been really fun to have a couple like Ethan's just like talking about like his hobbies, because we assume if he's not doing spy work, like he's got to be like, he probably built that
canoe. How do you get that adrenaline? Yeah.
Yeah. And then him like talking and like all these other like suburban guys that are like in their 30s and 40s are like,
we have other parts of the movie that we definitely need to get to, but have you guys ever been to an adult party where there's dancing?
Yes. Young adults.
I've never been to an adult party where there's dancing, and yet they are dancing at this engagement party.
You know what? I think that's a sad thing, Michael, and we need to change that. And maybe we need to have a dance party for the new movie. I'm
down for it.
In your basement. I think that's a prerequisite. I think it needs to happen. That's just sad. I'm just sad for you.
Well.
Oh, well. Okay. So we find out that one of Ethan's trainees has been captured. And he has been asked, quote unquote, through a Kodak camera, disposable camera that you take to summer camp, to lead a team to rescue her, which he does accept the mission. And now we enter the trope that J.J. Abrams is very well known for, lens flares. We go to the rescue mission in Germany, and immediately we are getting a lot of light into the camera, a lot of lens flares in the camera. Now, some people hate this. I don't mind it. I think it brings a lot of drama. And then, of course, who's on the team? Luther, our good friend, is back on the team. And then we also have Maggie Q playing Zen. And then we have Jonathan Rhys playing Declan, who I thought, I was surprised again that both those characters made it through as team members.
Yeah, I think they just needed people to like, to Jim's point earlier, this movie had some realism to it. And I don't know. I think they just needed some people to do things on these missions.
They didn't do a whole lot.
No.
One of them carried Philip Seymour Hoffman. That's a big job.
I actually had this thought when I was watching it, and I saw, I guess Maggie Q did a little bit in this first scene, in this first action scene. But in general, like, do you think Tom Cruise gets upset about doing everything always? Like, he's got this team of people, and like Luther, I get, he stays back, he's on the computer. He does everything always. Like, what did Jonathan, he flew the helicopter. Like, that's great. He didn't do anything else. Even Maggie Q just went in and grabbed a computer. Like, she didn't do a whole lot. He does everything.
She didn't. She hardly even grabbed it, too. She almost.
I think Ethan likes to do it all. I think he's a little bit of a prima donna. I think there's
support
a
delegator.
There's a reflection of his, the actor, into the character of Ethan in that way. They share a lot in common. I would say that's their biggest commonality, is they're kind of like, I like to do it all. Not a great delegator, I would say. But definitely the supportive people. Jonathan Rhys' character, I think he makes a joke that says, all I do is copy to Luther. I don't know if you caught that, which I think it was like,
yeah, I say that joke twice in the movie.
Yeah, I know.
Because Maggie Q spits it back out to her.
It's kind of all they do.
So Ethan says that he needs, Ethan's like alibi to like leave to go on this mission, though, is that he needs
a conference.
Just go to a public transportation conference
in Houston. Last minute.
Yeah, what kind of last minute public transportation conference are there?
You know, the writers have never been to a boring, like corporate or traditional work conference, because it would never be last minute unless you were a speaker or you were filling in for a speaker. So I thought that they missed a big opportunity to be.
Well, that's probably what he was, Luke. I mean,
but they should have just said that.
His revolutionary traffic modeling. And at first, there was a lot of issues with negotiating the fee that he was going to receive to go to this conference. And finally, at the last minute, they agreed to his rider to have, I don't know, whatever Ethan Hunt has in his rider.
He only wants green M&Ms. That's all you want. No, it wouldn't be that. It would be something like, it was something healthy, like kale. You need just kale chips in his chip bowl.
So one more thought on that though. I did enjoy that, like, that Michelle Monaghan, she did kind of call him out for that though.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And like, she knew it was garbage, but, and so they decided to get married ahead of time. Like, that's, I like that part of it. It's like, she's not just going to stomach this terrible excuse. Or was that after that scene? Am I getting the timeline messed up?
No, it was after.
Oh yeah.
That's right. Cause he's really upset.
It was after he comes back. Cause then she, but you're right, Jim, she does catch it immediately. And I think that's the writing and just the quality of actors, because, and just the tone, like we talk about Mission Impossible 2 is a very 90s action movie. Like, the only female character was essentially, she became a plot device. Whereas like, this is much more realistic writing. Like if you have someone that you're engaged to, like they can probably pick up if something's wrong. And she immediately starts picking up that something's wrong. And it's not dramatic either. I really like that later on they do have that conversation and he's like, I just need you to trust me. It's not like she, like, I feel like a lot of movies today would have had her like follow him around to see if he's cheating or something.
The hotel where he's supposedly staying in.
Yeah. And they would have, but it was just very simple. Like, yeah, if you're getting engaged with somebody, like you're good at picking up like their signs. And then also like establishing trust is really important.
So two things on the mission itself that I thought were really interesting. One, they have these like remote guns that Luther is controlling. But he's controlling them using the same mechanism that the golf games at the arcade use.
Golden tees. He basically has very high-level golden tees.
So I just imagine Luther, like, is a training exercise, is like in the IMF building, just ripping high scores in that game.
You know what it is? There's a golden tee in the break room, and he's so good at it. And he's like, there's like some Benji. He's like, hey, Benji. What if you took the golden tee and then put it on the device so I can control it like this?
Yeah, Benji came and was like, hey, we're trying to design a control system. He goes, I got it. Look at golden tee. And that is Luther. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, that is one of the things that I feel like does show this movie's age a little bit. Like, besides the Kodak camera, it's those. Because mid-2000s, I remember in like, that would have been high school, that would have been junior high for us. I remember having a mouse at my parents' house with one of those balls, big balls in it. And like, that was awesome back in the day. And they put it in there because it was awesome. Yeah. So, but besides that, I feel like this movie does good of not showing its age, but that plus the Kodak camera to me are like the two things.
The next thing I was going to say was later on in the mission when they're escaping, Ethan has perfected. So in the previous movie, he had a gun kick. Now he has the gun toss. It was a good gun toss to Kerry Russell.
Much more realistic. Yes. I do want to miss this note I had is that for any folks out there who have a lot of time on their hands, I would like a compilation ASMR YouTube video of Luther talking in to the comms when he's in the car. I just want a compilation of all the Luther talking into Mike ASMR, because it's so soothing when he's quietly talking into the earbud of Ethan. So anyways, they're going to get Kerry Russell's character, Lindsay Ferris, no relation. And again, Kerry Russell, amazing star, but also an Abrams collaborator from Felicity. She's a great actress because I feel like she's always up for anything, because her whole role is she's beat up from being tortured. She has to do an action sequence and then her character's killed. I mean, it's not a glamorous role at all.
So I had texted you guys in my mind, this is Kerry Russell before she was Kerry Russell. Mm-hmm. Do you guys agree with that? Like, this, she was not a big time actress at this point.
I feel like I knew who she was. I guess she wasn't as big time. Okay. I'm trying to think what movie would have.
I'm going through her filmography. So 2006, she was in Mission Impossible 3. Before that, her previous credits were Into the West, which was a TV miniseries, a TV movie that I won't even bother naming. She was in The Upside of Anger, Felicity. Obviously, she was in a ton of that. Yeah, she wasn't in.
So you're a ton. So you're right, Jim. So this, she was just coming from off from Felicity. It's only in retrospect is it like, wow, Keri Russell.
And fun fact, 1 year later in 2007, when August Rush comes out, she is the lead character with Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, who's also in Mission Impossible 3.
You're right. Okay.
So this is the start. To me, this is the start of Keri Russell's career.
This is not the first time in Mission Impossible where that's happened, where you have two actors, or maybe I'm thinking Jurassic Park 2, where you have two characters that work, that are in the same movie together, and then there are the two leads, because that happened with Julianne Moore and Vince Vaughn right after Jurassic Park 2. They did the reboot of Psycho together.
For Keri Russell, perhaps most importantly, this year, she's in Cocaine Bear.
Yes, most importantly, which I haven't seen yet. It's on my list. I'm very excited about it.
I haven't seen it yet either.
So they rescue her from the facility. A lot of guns. So we're trying to track the firearm usage of Ethan Hunt. This is a pretty firearm heavy movie. Yeah, pretty much throughout. So,
which was interesting because I recalled in our last podcast, Zach had mentioned that that they kind of went away from Ethan using guns, but in this movie, he's using guns all the time.
He is. So I think in the next film, it's gonna start to shift pretty drastically. This did feel like a firearm heavy movie.
So they come back and they get absolutely eviscerated by Lawrence Fishburne for failing this mission because Lindsay dies on the mission.
Yes. Yes.
And the whole objective was to recover her, to get intel so they could get close to Davian. But kind of like, and this is kind of the one unrealistic thing that I think exists in the movie is, I can understand Ethan going out rogue with Luther to do this kind of mission on the side, but the fact that he was able to get Declan and Maggie Q's character to also go along with it, I thought was really interesting. It seems odd that that he would be able to recruit them to kind of put their careers on the line for the sake of like him. I don't know.
Oh, like getting his former colleague, but Musgrave's pulling the strings, which he organized this whole thing, right?
Musgrave didn't even know about this. So what happened is they go to Benji. Benji gives them some information.
Oh, the next one. But yeah. The first one, because
Ethan Hunt even says we want Musgrave to have plausible deniability on this.
Right.
So they do this completely on their own. But that is kind of the Mission Impossible MO, though.
It is.
It's going. But
there's always like, let's do this on our own. Like, us against the world. Here's me and three of my buddies. Let's go figure this out. Right. You know, that is kind of the MO.
I do love Lawrence Fishburne in this. I think you could have done even more with him because he's so dynamic. But he sets up the stakes of the movie and gets all of the plot points out. He sets he's like, okay, here's the villain. Here's why he's bad. Here's the rabbit foot. I love that the rabbit foot as a MacGuffin like never gets explained and it's a joke at the end. To me, that's a total wink into the camera that this movie is not about. It's not about the big plot to destroy. It's very much emotion. It's a motion driven movie about Ethan in a relationship and then a villain who is like just wants to destroy that.
So yeah, it's stopping the villain more than stopping a catastrophic event.
Yeah. Which I love. I don't need a big like they're gonna like blow up the world. Like it doesn't matter because like as a spy story, like you can create drama so easily because being a spy or being an IMF agent is inherently risky and you're going to create enemies. And the whole tension of him trying to get out of IMF, like it's almost like too easy.
I agree, but this is why, and I'm pulling a note from the future about Fallout to talk about here, because I think that it is so applicable to the discussion that we're having right now. I agree with you guys that it's great that Mission Impossible 3 has this emotional, you are emotionally connected, you sympathize with, and you understand Ethan's motivation to do the things that he's doing to save the love of his life. And you also have, I think, to a certain extent, you have Davian, great villain, that you realize is just that, that Ethan's trying to stop. But he's not trying to stop Davian from accomplishing Davian's objective. He's trying to stop Davian from destroying Ethan. Does that make sense? And then to your point, this MacGuffin, this rabbit's foot, this is why Fallout is so good. Because Fallout actually has all three of those. You have a villain who has an objective that Ethan is actually trying to stop that's outside of Ethan. Then you have the same villain trying to destroy Ethan and the world at the same time. And you're also emotionally connected, invested, and understand and sympathize with Ethan. So that's the one thing I do think that this movie is missing, is it's missing that connection between those three elements.
And that's where you could say this is the building blocks of what's to come. Like, you can't have that without this movie. Without the emotional foundation and pillar of this movie, you can't have the payoff.
Yeah, but they didn't know that when they were making this.
Probably not. But
are you doubting J.J. Abrams here, Mike?
Yes.
This is before Iron Man, so we absolutely know for certain that there was no Hollywood producer or anybody in a production company that was thinking, let's create a 7, 10, 12, 15 movie storyline franchise, because that'll work. That is not a thing in Hollywood at this moment. Guys, I have to bring something up. It's a little bit – it's related, but I was shocked because I know this knowledge now, because I went a couple weeks ago to the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. And what did I see there? I learned about micro dots. When the micro dot came up, I freaked out because I realized that I just learned all about micro dots. They did say that it's old school, but it very much was the old school way that spies were able to get information to take photos. Micro dots were essentially you could take a little mini photo and then zoom in and get information on it. Kerry Russell did that in the technology. I don't know how that works, that she was able to get a video file on the micro dot, but we don't know what the megabyte transfer for that, but I thought that was kind of a fun nod to old school spy stuff. Also at the International Spy Museum, I did see an actual mask, like a traditional spy mask that was created in all the disguises. So that was really cool because we did get some masks in this one as well. So I had to give a shout out to the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Okay, where are we at in the... Okay.
We're about to go to the Vatican.
Vatican. Love that. I love the idea whoever thought of that in the writer's room was like, what's a place that would be really hard to get into? Vatican. That is... And is this when... At one point, Luther says... Oh, no. Later on in China, Luther says... He references the first movie where he says, this is going to be harder to get into than Langley. But the Vatican is definitely a step up. I really like the scene of Luther and Ethan talking about his relationship. And I appreciate about this movie is that they fit in a lot of the sleepover talk, as I like to call it. Like, oh, you like this girl? Like, I don't know if that's a good idea. They kind of fit that in mission prep, which I appreciate. And I don't know. Luther is a fantastic friend. He might be one of the best... Yeah. Like fictional friends that is not associated with like a real drama, like in an action sequence. Cause he's like, hey bro, like, did you have a thing for her? Like, was there something going on with your student? And he's like, no, she was my little sister. And he's like, so you didn't sleep with your little sister? And it's funny, but it's also like, he's like, hey bro, you're talking about getting married. And like, I'm feeling something there. And I think we're meant to feel a connection between the two and mm-hmm. like the guilt that Ethan feels. But Luther, being honest, I appreciate that like if you have a friend that's going to be honest with you and call you out when you're potentially doing bad things, Luther's a good candidate.
His response after Ethan tells him he already got married, I think is like perfect. Cause he's like trying to talk him out of it. Like, don't do it. You know, people like us can't get married. And he tells him he's married and he just, congratulations. I don't remember if he gives him a hug, but it's just like totally flips his reaction. It's great. Yeah. Luther's one of the best characters in these movies.
I feel like I have two Luthers on this podcast right now. So I appreciate you, both of you. You guys might not.
Yeah, I'm Benji. I'm Benji.
Oh, Benji. Benji, great friend. I can call you to give me directions.
That's right.
when I'm lost. Let's talk about Benji. This is his first introduction to the franchise. Simon Pegg obviously had just come off of Shaun of the Dead, fantastic movie, and I think Hot Fuzz as well. How did you like him being entered in the franchise? I love him as an actor, and I love him as a comedian and the stuff he does. But he obviously adds a whole nother element to the team. Luther is definitely, like we just said, Ethan's like rock, his moral compass, and Benji kind of serves as in James Bond, the Q character and a comedic character.
Yeah, I like him. I do think that probably because of time, you don't really get to understand why Ethan has this rapport with him. Because Ethan's asking him to do some things that are pretty sketchy. And also Benji shares information with Ethan before he reports it up his chain of command. So, there's this relationship that Ethan probably has because he trains now. So there's probably some office relationship now because he's not in the field as often. And I understand all that, but that's like the one little thing that you're just missing here, but it's pretty obvious that outside of Luther, like Benji's one of Ethan's little work buddies.
Yeah, it's when you trim the fat of a movie, like an action movie, you do miss that. Like, I want to know all the office hijinks that was happening between the two, because obviously he has this direct line, and Benji trusts him and is willing to like put his neck out on the line.
Yeah, I think the Benji characters. I think Benji's great because Luther is comedic relief, but only so much. Like we were just talking about, he is kind of like the big brother too, but Benji is the comedic relief. Like Luther tries, Luther dabbles in the comedy, but Benji is the comedic relief. And I think it helps keep these movies a little bit lighter. Otherwise, it's just kind of shoot 'em up, blow 'em up. And I think you lose a lot of what makes these movies good is that the tone does change and it can be lighter and it can be funnier. And it's not just I don't know. It adds an extra bit to it, which I like. And he's just so funny. Simon Pegg's awesome.
He's the best. And to bring it back to Alias, Alias does have a Q character in Marshall that serves a very similar purpose. But in the same way that Alias uses it as comic relief to play off the seriousness of the story, as the story continues, both Benji and Marshall add emotion to it because of the friendship, which is the best kind of, when we have these fun movies, like you said, Jim, the Scooby gang aspect of it, of like the collective friendship and going on missions, as an audience, you feel attached to that. Cause you feel that connection. And I think I forgot how little he's in this. And I actually was like, why can't I get some more Benji? Like I need more. I need more Benji in my life. But it's just getting started, folks. So you have plenty more to look at.
I was just going to say, it's also interesting because Benji becomes far more field present in later movies. So you kind of get this impression from this movie that he's just kind of like in what show is it? In, oh my gosh.
Alias.
Alias.
No. NCIS. where... Where there's like, is it NCIS where there's one character and she's just kind of like on the computer the whole time, but she's like super important to everything they're doing.
Mike.
I don't know. You only watch Alias. Okay.
I do not watch CBS programming targeted for 55-year-old men. I'm sorry.
I don't either. But anyway, so you kind of get this impression that he's just backroom. You know, he's kind of like Luther in some way. But in later movies, he becomes very active.
Because as we know in the James Bond franchise, Q in the field is always better. Benji in the field only adds to the movie. I have a quote from Luther. Well, that look in your eyes is a pain in my ass.
I knew I wanted to talk about that too. It's such a good line.
Luther is written really, the writing for him in this movie is so far, I think it's the best. He has
funny thing about that line, it's actually the tagline for season two of Alias.
It could be, that's for sure. We do learn that Ethan's middle name is Matthew Hunt. We didn't mention that his parents have passed. And so he shares that in common with...
I didn't even catch that. Julia. I've seen this movie like 18 times.
It's at the party, and the sister, Ethan's eventual sister-in-law, talks about how Julia's dad's passed away, and she says, I know Ethan doesn't have your parents, and they would want to be here. So do they get married before the Vatican heist or after?
Yes.
It's before.
Before. Okay, because we do have sexy time in the closet. I'm glad they waited for marriage. And then we go to Italy to take on the Vatican. The one thing that really took me out of the movie is when they're pretending to be Italian Hertz drivers or whatever.
I love that.
That was so good.
Because they are two of the least looking Italian men of all time. And then I love how that the joke of don't forget to smoke, just leaning into the Italian stereotype. It's like right on the edge.
It's just super good. A little and absurd. Also, I love the talking with their hands. I also love, not related to the Italian-ness portion, but there's so many gadgets you see in this little like bit. Ethan's got this grappling hook that he walks up the wall with, which is kind of neat. And then he's got a fancy Polaroid camera that he
with the hinge.
Hinge.
Who's thought of that with the hinge? It's I like it because
it's a good design.
Because it's very much a manual way to, because the classic thing in spy movies is some hacker just goes up to an Ethernet and like somehow is able to like change the camera film or the film of the security camera. Whereas very analog, Ethan has a black and white photo over the security camera. Okay, I want to ask you guys something. When Ethan gets on the wall of the Vatican, he's laying down and he says, Humpty Dumpty said it on the wall. I'm assuming that was the call to say he's made it, but he stares directly into camera as it's happening.
I know.
Yeah, I would suspect that's the call to Declan to move the van.
That's what it seemed, but it was the one point in the movie. There's one other point in the movie, but that was the one point in the movie where I was like a little too far at the edge, like
too far. Yeah.
Directly into camera. It was that's when it felt a little Mission Impossible 2 to me, which isn't bad. It's not a bad thing.
You're so right about that.
That's not a bad thing, but that's when it like kind of dipped its toes, which I don't mind as a franchise. If you're like, hey, we're going to get a little Mission Impossible 2-y here. We're going to get a little Roger Moore, James Bond here. That's totally fine.
He could have winked.
He could.
Going back to the Italian thing too, I love the way like that cues him to move the van and how that like ends the Italian bit on the street. And he's like all happy, you know, waving to the cars. Oh, scusa, bada, bada, it's all good. And everyone behind him's like smiling and waving. Like everyone's happy, happy, bad, happy Italians. Just like adds to the stereotype of Italians for that whole
thing. Totally adds.
Like, I don't like where this podcast is going. It wraps that bit up so well.
And then later, Becky Q spills red wine on Philip Seymour Hoffman, just like to make
which
sure.
Which his line, Italy. You can hardly hear Philip Seymour Hoffman's line there because there's so much noise. But he says, "Oh yeah, I always love to spill red wine on my custom white shirt or something like that."
That's a good little line. That one felt improvised. He delivered that perfectly. First mask. We did mention the mask. This is the first mask in the first iteration of the 3D printing mask. Is that correct, gentlemen? So and are you in the field?
I think it's the first time we just see how the masks are made. So yeah. I think
technically that's 3D printing, right? Like that's early 3D printing. Is that what they're trying to reference or is it something different?
I think they're just trying to, I don't know. I just think they're trying to, because we never get to see how the masks are made otherwise.
Yeah, because in the first couple, they come prepared with them, right? They're already on, or they have. Right. Yeah, this is the first time they make them on the fly.
The whole plot here is to essentially have Ethan double so they can steal the briefcase that he has so we can learn more about his clients. There's a great scene in the bathroom where Ethan is dressed up in the mask and they have that Jimmy Fallon, Mick Jagger SNL skit, like both looking at each other in the mirror. That's a great bit because essentially they have him read a script to what we now know is like voice AI. So Ethan can match his pitch, but it's taking time to process. It's early AI. It doesn't happen that rapidly. And so Ethan has to like kill time as the security card comes in. I love that scene. It's a fun way to like a fun play on the masks. And I think this is the beginning of the Mission Impossible. It happens in the first movie for sure, but we see this more of throughout the mission. There's a lot of mishaps. And I feel like that continues to happen in this film, but also as we move on, that there's a lot of improvisation within the mission that needs to happen.
Which how do they cover their butts?
Exactly. Which I feel like it did happen in the first movie. Not really that much in the second, but it really starts to ramp up and is why these movies are so fun. Anything else about the Vatican?
I just love getting blown up.
I think it's a great heist. I think it's great.
Yeah.
I think like the masks. Okay. From a realism standpoint, are you going to make a mask that matches someone perfectly in the field like that? No. But in general, like that whole heist, like climb the wall, fool the camera, impersonate the guy, steal him, blow up the car, make sure everyone thinks he's dead. It's like, it's so clean. It's not, there's no fluff. There's no crazy, let's go do something insane. This is like what I said before. Like, it's so like, yes, some spy somewhere did something similar just to kidnap somebody sometime. And I would totally buy it that somebody did it this exact same way. Cause it's super clean, super great. Maybe not the Vatican, but you know, just great.
I do think the practicality of the switch with Maggie Hughes' character that she spills on the red wine. And then afterwards kind of like, it's like, oh, I'm going to take you back to my hotel. It's like a very, like, again, it's very espionage. It's not necessarily like something crazy. I do love that line where they're going down into the gutter and Maggie Q goes, do I have to blow up the car? It's very, very sad because she was matching the car. It was a whole vibe that she didn't have a lot to do, but you could tell as a character, she was putting everything into that heist. She went above and beyond.
I love the tension of the bodyguard in the bathroom scene. I just think that's just really good tension building there. And just the way the door is falling, like you can tell like that was just choreographed very well. Great acting by Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Ethan Hunt there.
Yeah. Which he does before they even get up into the Vatican when they're in the sewer, which I thought that transition of putting on the mask and building it still held up really well. I know there was some CGI that they added in there, but it was a really smooth transition to like essentially changing actors.
So what I thought would be kind of funny would be if they had done this all practically and done it with two Philip Seymour Hoffmans and Tom Cruise was actually all makeuped as like a Philip Seymour Hoffman climbing through the rafters. And like Philip Seymour Hoffman probably said like, hey, I can do that. Like it's just climbing through some rafters. And
yeah,
it's like, no. No, this is a stunt. We're going to have Ethan do it. We're going to
It's a stunt. So we move on. I think my favorite scene in the movie is when they're on the plane flying back and it's just Philip Seymour Hoffman, like the opener, it is him at his best. He owns this scene. And Cruise, which I would say as an actor, when Cruise is at his best is when he plays vulnerable and out of control, like A Few Good Men. Like a lot of – like when he's paired up with a great – actor and he's kind of loses it like that, to me that reminds me of just like the best Tom Cruise moments. This moment where Ethan realizes that this guy knows way more about him than he realizes.
Yeah.
And I like, it's just the writing's so good. He's like, you got a girlfriend? And this is in the original trailer. I remember this trailer because they cut up this scene, but the original trailer uses this scene. It's just absolutely my favorite.
Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman just kills it. Like, you have a girlfriend? I'm going to find her. I'm going to hurt her. Just the way he delivers that whole thing. Oh, it's so good. He is so good.
The arrogance that his character is. Yeah. It's just, every time I watch this movie, I don't think we've said this, but rest in peace, Philip Seymour Hoffman, because he is just one of the all time great actors. His range is just so good. Like, I can't help but always just think Along Came Polly when I see him in any movie. Say, rain, make it rain. Gosh, he is just so good. And this scene is just another great example of just how well he understood like the role and how well he understood like the arrogance of the character. And it's just, I love it.
Could you imagine, and obviously you can't because he's passed sadly. Could you imagine if I think they could have done it. He got hit by a truck, definitely dead. But could you imagine if they brought him back and he somehow survived that? I know it doesn't fit perfectly with Mission Impossible 3 because they would have mentioned that his body disappeared. But it would have been cool if they would have been to bring him back for the seventh and eighth.
I mean, we'll get into it when we get into the later movies, but I think it's fair to make an argument that Davian is potentially the best villain in all of the Mission Impossible movies. Now, I think that that's a losing argument. I think that if you tried to make that argument, you would eventually lose. Because Solomon is just so, so over the top deviant. Like, it's just crazy.
Yeah. That's the thing I think about this franchise that I, going back and doing this, I've underestimated because I know it's coming and the villains are really good.
Yeah.
They're not as flashy and memorable as other franchises, but I don't need that. They're just good, evil characters.
Who's the only Bond villain that I've really loved in the last 20 years has been, who's the guy that did No Country for Old Men?
Javier Bardem and Skyfall.
Javier Bardem's character, I love.
So good.
I love him. I think I like Mikkel, the guy from Casino Royale. He's really good.
Yeah. Yeah, he's good too.
I like him a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
He's fantastic. But so yeah.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that the quality of the villains in the Mission Impossible franchise is superior to the quality of villains in the James Bond franchise. With a couple exceptions where I can point to a James Bond villain and say, yeah, that guy's frightening. That guy is absolutely terrifying. But you also don't get the vulnerability of James Bond that you tend to get with Ethan Hunt. And I think that amplifies the villain a little bit.
Right. We do see Ethan doing some high level math and physics later on. And that did remind me of James Bond. We're like, James Bond knows everything about diamonds and already knows the year that Sherry was cast just by the smell, you know, stuff like that. So
I did bring that up. I sketched that out at work today on a whiteboard to show one of our engineering experts. And we were just talking about how it was just like, you know, it's one thing to assume that he has the technical expertise to sketch this out on a window 14 miles away from the buildings without ever even considering weather conditions or anything like that. It's another thing for him to do it in an hour and 45 minutes after he sketches it on the window.
So that was the one thing in this movie that got me. They are, to your point, however many miles away from those buildings, they don't have anything, right? They come up with a baseball flinging machine and baseballs at night in Beijing.
Yeah.
They have all the cabling they need and the hoist for the cabling. transit time, climbing time, prep time, and they had 2 hours to do it. Well, less than that, probably we'll call it an hour and 45 minutes because the time to actually do the mission and then the time after that, because it was 5 seconds to make the phone call. That part of the whole movie, like if they had said 6 hours, I would have bought it. But when he said 2 hours, I'm like, yeah, man, I wish you had picked a different time.
Yeah, that, and I know we're skipping ahead, but I do think that probably that's probably the weakest sequence of the movie. I don't want to skip over the bridge scene because essentially what Ethan goes back, they get chewed out by Larry Fishburne. Essentially, Ethan's kind of framed. For psych fans out there, Timothy Osmond is playing one of the IMF agents. So Lassie apparently is doing some federal work, and the rest, Ethan. And then Davian essentially uses the we go back from the beginning, the lip reading. He tells Ethan, basically allows him to escape, so they can essentially. Well, that happens after he gets attacked at the bridge and Davian escapes. I'm kind of jumping all over the place. One of the things I do want to say is on the bridge sequence, one of the best stunt shots is obviously they didn't fire a real missile at the bridge, but the concussion of the missile hitting the car and Tom Cruise hitting the bridge and Tom Cruise like flailing into the car was a practical stunt, and he did it multiple times. It's one of my favorite shots of the movie.
That scene alone has got to be a big percentage of that $150 million budget to make it.
Yeah.
That's a big scene. It's a great scene.
It's a great scene. Great sequence. I love his jump over the gap too, and how he jumps, but he barely makes it and has to climb up and he's late. And then another just we I don't know how much we can talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman as an actor, especially in a shot like this. His look from the helicopter, the
stare down, so good.
How as an actor, like you're in this action sequence, a long shot, like to be able to be like, I am fully in my character enough and strong enough an actor to make a shot like that compelling, where it's a total action sequence, and the look says everything. He doesn't need to say a line. He's like, I'm coming for you. Like, I'm on top now, bro. Like, watch out. It's
so good.
Fast forward, Ethan escapes. Obviously, we're worried about Julia, runs to the hospital, and she is captured. And it really sets up the final third of the movie. Tom Cruise does a great job. Lots of running in this sequence, but you can tell he's freaking out. Like he's.
Yeah. We haven't even talked about how much running he does in this movie.
Yeah. So let's do a running check-in, Mike. Where are we at for this film with running?
Yeah. So he runs for a total of 159 seconds in this movie. So that's just about like it's over 2.5 minutes. That he's running, which is pretty long. I mean,
that's a lot.
That's a lot of screen time running, and
a big chunk of that is going to come later in the final sequence. But I would say the second half of the film, really, there's a lot more running. I'm trying to think about this. I've got the lip reading.
The lip reading that was built up in one of the first scenes of the movie.
Great.
One of the things I love here is another elevator shaft. That's three movies and three elevator shafts if you're counting.
We love a good shaft in the Mission Impossible franchise. The shaft is there. Did you notice that he escapes through the Virginia Department of Transport?
Yeah, I thought that was
where he's supposed to work. I thought that was cute. Nice.
Yeah,
that was a nice joke for a rewatch.
Oh, I didn't catch that. That's great. Think about that. I noticed the Virginia Department of Transportation, but I didn't put two and two together that was his job from the beginning. That's fine.
I really like the practical move of taking the radio transmitter and like talking into it and then holding on to the transmit button to like and Michael. Obviously, they're trying to find the frequency.
Yes. Yeah, they found the frequency, actually.
They found the frequency. Yeah, the frequency was closed.
If you're a Jurassic Park 2 fan.
Yeah, shout out to Jurassic Pod listeners. Shout out to Jeff Goldblum. Shout out to The Frequency.
Shout out to The Frequency.
And then he puts just The Frequencies. And then he puts the walkie-talkie, the radio, next to office boombox, which is a thing of the past, where people would actually have boomboxes in their office space to play music. And the song is We Are Family. It's a really fun needle drop. It's a joke needle drop, but also, I don't know, it worked for me. I'm sure some people didn't like it, but Larry Fishburne does a good job reacting to it. He's in shock.
It's beautiful.
So Tom Cruise gets away dressed as in disguise as a 70s prog rocker. And then, of course, his team is with him to the end, totally loyal. As I mentioned earlier, Luther says Langley was a cakewalk compared to this, referencing the first one. Essentially, they're doing a fulcrum jump, and baseballs are involved, like we said earlier. I don't know how it all works, but the math is on the board. You can screenshot it and check it yourself.
He writes like an equation for like density. It's like, what are you doing?
I like that Luther gives him a pep talk, and it's just, he's so good in this, and also outlines the stakes. Like, are you sure you want to do this? And then he makes it. And then again, this is a really interesting sequence. Obviously the fulcrum jump and stuff, it doesn't work for me, but him falling down it reminds me of Spielberg. It's very Spielberg kind of comical action sequences getting into the street. There was a sequence there where Maggie Q and Jonathan Rye's character are taught. She's praying, and she does this prayer in the car, and he's like, "Can you teach me that?" And they never follow up on it.
Yeah, I don't know. That seems weird.
I'm almost 100% certain there was a scene cut, because that makes no sense. It makes no sense, because I'm like, oh, are they trying to like? I honestly was like, does one of them die? And then, like, does Maggie Hugh die? And then he, like, says a prayer, or he dies and she says the prayer.
Yeah, it seems weird. It just seems like, it almost seems like you cut that 5 seconds.
It's really weird. I think part of it, they want the harsh cut of, like, Ethan Hunt on the radio saying, like, guys, and then he jumps out the window. I think they want that harsh cut. But I feel like they could have just done a joke, but I don't know. It's weird that they kept that in. That was the only other part of the movie that was kind of took me out. We have Indiana Jones sequence in the streets of Shanghai. Again, they're trying to get a cell phone signal, so getting the frequencies if they're everywhere. I appreciate a movie that's set in its time, and yes. 2006, if you had cell phones, very, very difficult to get signal, especially in a big city. You're in tunnels. Very real. People don't think about that today, but back then, very real. Cars didn't have.
If you were 12 years old and you had a cell phone, it was difficult to get service
anywhere and everywhere.
Because to be fair, none of us really had to deal with that very often.
Well, I didn't have a cell phone until I was 16, and
I had one when I was 13.
It was a block. It was a like kind of the block phone that you could slide up. It wasn't a Razor. It wasn't that cool. Which Tom Cruise does have kind of like a Razor style phone at the end. I don't know if you guys noticed it. It's like the Sony version of a Razor.
Yeah, it was a cool looking phone, to be honest. Do you remember flip phones? Flip phones were like super cool.
I think they're still cool. I actually think flip phones are way cool. Like if I saw somebody walking down the street like with, I'm going to go on a tangent here. To me, flip phones, just like even a basic, like the old school simple black ones with the antenna sticking out, to me, it goes right back to the first Matrix movie where Keanu Reeves has that and he's running through the cubicles, getting away from the agents. And he's like, what's happening? Like, to me, like flip phones will always be cool because of that scene. So.
Do they have those in Alias too, Luke?
Absolutely. Flip phones are everywhere in Alias. Everywhere in Alias. Everywhere. I actually think I had another Alias. we get the betrayal reveal. This is also very Alias. I knew I had a couple more Aliases left in me. This is classic Alias betrayals. You don't know who to trust. It's perfection. Great reveal.
It is. It is nice that like you find out that Tom Cruise didn't like know all along. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He didn't have it all figured out. Like he's fooled with the audience.
Yeah, he's got his blinders on. I mean, I love when he yells, "Don't you touch her!" after he thinks like it's her dead body. Like it's really powerful. And we find out Julia doesn't. It's not Julia. She has a mask. So another mask. Not a lot of. I mean, two masks in this movie, but used to perfection.
Used well.
I like that they have that fact of it was Damien's assistant who was also head of security when they were in the Vatican who got back at her and killed her, who failed because of the whole thing. So just adds into the ruthlessness storyline of him.
Totally. And again, every piece of dialogue is used to like connect to the story. It's all used so well. I think so the whole idea of Musgraves is he's trying to take justice into his own hands. I don't have the line specifically, but he's talking about Theodore Brassel. He says affirmative action poster boy. So it's very much, he's a disgruntled employee, and it's very much like post 9/11 Iraq war, like 2006, where like we're in that Iraq war muck. Like it connects to what's happening there about like, you know, America does, like democracy wins and America cleans it up. It's very much a commentary of that time and a view of, you know, our military focus and what we're about as a country. I think it ties in nice. It's not overly political, but I think it connects with what's happening in the era. And then we get, the chase. He's got to go get Julia. Which is, again, it is a damsel in distress, but I think it's been built up and earned compared to the last movie. Much better.
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines talking about using dialogue to the best of its ability, Ethan is trying to find Julia, calls Benji, as we discussed earlier. He says a line. He says, "I think I'll lose my citizenship for this," which is extremely clever writing because you're essentially covering your ass that this American intelligence agent has a British accent. Now they didn't. To be fair, they didn't do that with John Rhys' character, but I think it was a nice setup for Benji. And I love when he says, "Hold the line, please."
Yeah, that was good. But he doesn't even press hold. He just puts the phone down on the desk.
It's so good. So frantic. I love it. It's just great acting because he's like, when you have a real comedian, he's creating the comedy.
Right.
Like they have one person come up to him, but it's just him. It's very old school Monty Python, British humor. Like he's just using his face, his body language to create the comedy of like, he's very paranoid, but wants to help Ethan find Julia using the GPS. My question for you guys, is this the best cruise running scene ever? Is this on the hull, on like the Mount Rushmore of cruise running? This has to be on there, right?
It's up there.
No.
Oh,
no.
No.
No. It's up there. It is.
Yeah, it's up there. I mean, I don't even know if it's necessarily top four, but I mean, it's up there.
Wow. You know what? You guys are tough. I think this is one of the best uses of a crane shot I've ever. Like the coordination, I think it's so simple but so complicated, and for them to pull it off in camera is amazing to me without very limited cuts. And this is before all the one shot stuff that would come with Birdman and 1917. Like this is before a lot of the technology allowed for those like very famous oneers that we've seen over the last 20 years. So I love it. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I think an underappreciated Tom Cruise run is actually in The Firm.
Wow. Yeah. Good pull.
It's The Firm, great great movie based on the great book by John Grisham. Watch it if you haven't. But Tom Cruise, I think he's I think there's a really good running scene in The Firm.
We might have to do a extra episode of best Tom Cruise runs and rank them.
I'm just rewatching it right now, and
is that where he starts slow and then speeds up? I'm trying to remember it.
He's
in the full suit, right? He's in the full suit.
Yes, he's in a tuxedo, and it. So this is the plug. Just go watch The Firm. It's a great movie. It's worth watching. Tom Cruise has a phenomenal running scene, and more than just one running scene in that movie, of course.
We're gonna do a top 10 Tom Cruise running scenes.
Okay. Rankings. All right. I'll send you guys the video that has it's a super cut of every single one of his running scenes.
Okay. That'll be the prep. We'll bring Jim back for that rankings episode.
Yeah. So for reference, I just Googled best Tom Cruise runs, and Mission Impossible 3 is number 5 on what Google immediately pulls up with no other research and no other digging. It was 5.
Okay.
It's in the conversation.
Oh, yeah. It's a great run. It is a good run.
Is The Firm on that list?
Not in the top 5.
So here's the problem. Here's the problem, okay? That list is biased, and the reason why is because I'm sure, and correct me if I'm wrong, every single one of the movies that lists him running on that list is an action movie.
Or Paramount.
Yeah, they are all action movies. I will say there are some good ones. There's some good ones on here on this list.
I think there's going to be some good ones.
I don't know. You're going to have a hard time breaking into the top 10.
Think of some of his other
movies, like War of the Worlds. He's got some good running in. Edge of Tomorrow, he runs a little bit, and he's got Edge of
Tomorrow is really good. We might have to do an extra Edge of Tomorrow episode and continue the cruise train rolling. Of course, there's going to be a running scene to come that I think is probably his best or one of his best, where he gave his body.
What do you mean Edge of Tomorrow? Do you mean Live, Die, Repeat?
Yes. but when he sprains his ankle in London, running through the office complex, is that in Rogue Nation?
I don't know which one that one is. There is, so I'm not going to. Do I want me to spoil it now? So there is another one that on the list I have looked at that is a Mission Impossible running scene that is the highest that is consistently the highest. Yeah.
Spoil it.
It's when he's running away from the sandstorm.
Oh yeah, of course.
That has been number one on this, but I did find a list with The Firm on it, Mike. So there you go.
Okay, the firm's also in the conversation. Now we have to do an episode on it. We have to do a rankings episode. It's going to happen. All right, Ethan is running to save Julia. I really like how easily Ethan takes down Philip Seymour Hoffman physically.
Yeah.
Obviously this is after the bomb in his head, which we haven't talked about, which is a great, I know it's not probably not super realistic, but it's a really fun, good
device.
Super fun action device and I love it with the villain is like it humbles Ethan's ability to physically defeat him. And it adds that tension. And then it also gives something for Ethan to do after. Here's the thing to compare to James Bond. A lot of times when James Bond franchise movies, when the main villain is not physically superior, and that happens a lot, either like intellectually superior or more ruthless, they are killed first. And then Bond has to go and fight the Jaws, the henchmen, whoever it is. I like this because it's not like a henchman. It's specifically, it's like a device that the villain had implanted in him. And it's really cool. I also like that you kind of bring it back where Julia is a nurse, so she's aware that she's not only aware of Ethan having to do that to himself, like because he's trying to find a defibrillator and then basically has to like electrocute himself. She would know CPR 100% without a doubt. We know because she's a nurse. Like, of course she knows CPR. just really good writing. Like, you could have made her any other job profession, but it makes sense that as a nurse, she would be able to bring him back. And that's why he's so confident.
Yeah.
You'll bring me back.
I don't think that that's what he's saying. I don't think that he's saying in that line, which I think is a just hilarious line, I'll come back. I don't think he's saying that he has confidence in her bringing him back, although I'm sure that that's true. I think he's just so arrogant and just so self-centered that he's like, no, I'll come back. Of course I'll come back.
That's true.
Like, I can't.
Force of will.
I'm Ethan Hunt.
That's true. Force of will. I do like the, I don't know if it was intentional. Maybe they did it on the day when he like is getting ready and then he like pulls out the bite and says, I love you. I think that's sweet. That warmed my heart.
Yeah. Actually, I think he takes it and goes, you had me at hello, and then puts it back in.
Could you imagine if he actually said that?
I really love that sequence.
You because complete me.
You complete me. I appreciate when he's trying to tell her how to use a firearm. It's very practical and very grounded, but also kind of funny in the tension building. He says, it's very simple, very easy, point and shoot. But then you feel the tension of her. You're, as an audience member, you're put in her shoes where she doesn't know really what she's doing. Like, she pulls the trigger like 8 times to like hit a guy.
Yeah,
I actually love that part of it, that she just unloads. Because how does Joe Schmo know when to stop?
Yeah,
right.
No, you know, we would all.
Like, she just completely empties the clip and has to put a new one. It like totally adds into the whole. She doesn't know what she's doing. I thought that's a great little touch.
And yeah, she gets Musgrave as well, who has the rabbit's foot. And then she does CPR in the correct way, which I always appreciate in a movie that they like actually do the countdown.
No longer the correct way, by the way.
Is that no longer the correct? I see. I haven't done the training in.
You're not supposed to do six or seven years. Mouth to mouth anymore. You're just supposed to do the chest compressions.
Okay.
So I asked Lindsay, who just got CPR certified, like literally 2 or 3 days ago. What she said is you can do the breaths. The problem is they tell people that you don't need to do the breaths because most people do the breaths wrong. Because you're supposed to like straighten up the head and like lift the neck while you do it.
The head tilt.
So it aligns at the head tilt. Yeah. No, nobody does that. So they're like, the breathing does nothing. So unless you're going to do the breathing right, you are taking away from compressions to do poor mouth breathing. So they just say, don't even worry about the breathing in the mouth and just keep doing compressions. But you can do the breaths. So I don't think it's wrong to do the breaths. It's just wrong
if
to do the breaths
if you do the breaths wrong. Yeah, like in other movies where they just like when Wendy Peppercorn is trying to resuscitate Squints in the Sandlot, I don't think she like adjusts his head correctly.
I don't think he's worried about it, Luke.
Now, again, he wasn't actually needing CPR, as we do learn. Squints hashtag legend, and really nice scene. They like he obviously resuscitates, and then he's like, "Did you do that?" It's a great fun line, and they walk away. One of the best jokes in the movie. He's telling her what he does. I work for IMF, and she asks, "What does that stand for?" Impossible Mission Force, and she's like, "Seriously?"
Yeah, yeah.
Great joke. Great self-aware joke about the movie. We go back to the IMF headquarters. Obviously, Ethan gets a nice printed paper, basically releasing him from anything that would entangle him from being thrown in jail, essentially. Everything's nullified. But he does ask, what was the rabbit's foot?
Yeah.
Which I think is a nice tease to say, hey, Ethan's, he may have gotten away with this, but he needs the field. It's a nice tease that there could be a sequel without like technically and traditionally setting up a sequel.
Well, it's a very similar tease. Sorry, Mike. It's a very similar tease to the beginning of the movie where they say, where he just hangs the camera on the shelf.
Right.
And it's like, You can grab it. You have to do it the same way Lawrence Fishburne is like, I'll tell you, but you got to come back. Like you have to sign up to get it. It very much mirrors the beginning where Ethan is making the choice to stay doing
it. I like that because you're right, Jim. They're kind of like, they know him, right? They have his file. They know their assets. Like they know he's a junkie and they just got to, you know, give him a little bit at a time. You know, they just got to. They can't give him an overdose. They can't give him everything. He's got to lay the crumb trail there.
It's like good. That. And then we have Julia meeting all of Ethan's real coworkers, which is great. And then they kind of walk away smiling into the sunset. And that is the end of Mission Impossible 3. Wow. What a nice, tight, beautiful, fantastic, lovely, heartwarming, thrilling, gorgeous Tom Cruise running action movie. So now comes the time where we rate the film. Jim, we rate the movie on masks. So not stars, not numerals. We rate it.
If you have masks. A better idea of how we can rate these movies.
Nope, we're committed. We're already two in. This is going to be the third. Out of five masks, five being the best, one being the worst, how would you rate Mission Impossible 3? To give you context, to give you, because you're fair, you're coming to the guest just for Mission Impossible 3. The last film that we rated, which was Mission Impossible 2, I gave it 3 out of 5 masks. Mike gave it 2.5 out of 5 masks. And then our guest, Zach, gave it 4 masks.
4 masks?
Zach is, we want him in specifically for Mission Impossible 2. He's a Mission Impossible 2 apologist, so okay. That's why he's there.
Because I was going to say, I was going to give you crap, Luke, because in Jurassic Pod, the newest Jurassic World, you were higher than Mike and I.
Well, Luke has a relevancy bias.
I do have a, if you listen to Jurassic Pod, please go back, listen to Jurassic Pod about the latest Jurassic World film, which we all saw together in the theaters. And then we did an episode right after. I was on a post theater high with my friends, which automatically adds a 20% improvement rate to any film. I think it was probably a 50% improvement rate on that film.
Luke would have given Scream like a 15 out of 10 after we went and saw it.
Which you missed, Mike. I was very sad to see Scream Alone this weekend, but
why would you do that?
It's really good.
I'm going to be in town soon.
I couldn't wait. We can watch it though. We can watch it when you get here.
Okay.
Anyways, Jim.
So Mission Impossible 3. I'm trying to decide if my gut instinct is slightly too high and I need to back it down. It's a 4.5.
Absolutely. It's so good. Yes, absolutely, yes.
I was going to say it's 4.5 too high, and I was going to do like 4.25
because 4
is too low.
Four and a half is good.
It's so good.
Yeah, 4.5 is good.
Are you 4.5, Mike?
Yes.
I'm also 4.5, and that was before I walked in today.
Yeah.
I was 4.5 all the way.
Yep.
Yeah, it's funny because usually I'd watch them. It's been a while since I've watched Mission Impossible 3, I'll be honest. I've been watching the more recent ones because those are more accessible. And typically I go back and I watch an older movie and I find that I don't like it as much and I knock it down a little bit. Did not feel that way for this one. I loved it just as much watching it now as I did, I don't know, a couple of years ago when I watched it last time.
Yeah.
So good.
Shannon actually mentioned that.
Shannon, for listeners, your wife. Shannon's your wife.
Shannon, my wife. Yes.
Your beautiful wife.
Yeah. Beautiful wife. Yep. Shannon mentioned that she thinks that this is the best Mission Impossible movie. She has seen all of them. She understands my feelings on each of them. She doesn't care. She's unapologetic about it. She says this is the best Mission Impossible movie. So she would probably give it a
good 5. Argument.
The connection between Julia and Ethan and that being the motivation is so accessible to any film goer, and it drives the movie. Beyond the stunts, beyond the gadgets, beyond anything else, it's the emotions of the characters that drive it, which is very much, as we know from the director down to the editor to the writer, it is a continuation of one of the greatest television shows of all time, Alias. So, yes, I would agree.
Is that your final Alias?
That is it.
Okay, that is 11 alias references.
It could have been more. It could have been more, honestly. You know what's ironic? That J.J. Abrams made Alias, and he also created Lost.
Oh.
Not a huge Lost fan. And if there was a different version of Luke in a different alternate universe that was a huge Lost fan, he probably could have made maybe 12 Lost references in this episode, but he didn't.
Yeah. J.J. Abrams also, I don't know like what God he's praying to in the film industry, but he got to do Star Trek and Star Wars, which it should just be illegal to be able to do both.
I think when you really step back from it, I'm glad you brought it up, because when you really step back from it, it's absurd.
It is.
Like, it should have never happened. There's no way that would ever happen. It was the time. It was all timing, and paired with his skills and abilities and his track record.
Well, it's all because we know. Like we all knew Patton Oswalt should have done it. You know, should have done Star Wars. You know, he
had it in Parks and Rec.
Yeah,
he had it. He had it in his filibuster. He had it. Well, I think that is a perfect way to end it. Besides. Once again, plugging Alias as one of the greatest shows of all time, and The Firm as another great film.
Yes, The Firm.
Plug those two films. Jim, any final words about the franchise? What are your thoughts on this movie and going forward in the new movie?
I cannot wait for the new movie. I've been waiting for the new movie since the last movie came out. I don't love that it's a two-parter. Mm-hmm. I have opinions. I could have a whole podcast about my opinions on two-part movies.
Don't think of it as a two-parter. Think of it as two movies.
No, it's a two-parter. And I just don't love that. Yeah, I don't love that. That's hard for me to swallow. I would sit through a three and a half hour movie before I'd want to sit through two movies.
I think it's a fair point.
A year apart.
I think the track record for two-part movies is not great. I don't think sets the audience up well. And maybe we need to do a pregame episode. So maybe we'll bring you back as we prepare. Like, you know how in the Super Bowl they had like an eight hour pregame show?
Like, we do a live stream at the theater.
A live show at the theater.
In Germany. Because remember, Jurassic Pod is huge in Germany.
Huge. Huge for our German listeners that have come over to the Least Important Things feed to listen to Podcast Impossible. Mike, final thoughts on Mission Impossible 3 before we self-destruct?
I think you have to be super excited after watching Mission Impossible 3 to see where Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation are. Or I think it's Rogue Nation first. I forget. Whichever the next one is, you got to be super excited about that one.
Again, Mike, you said at the end of last episode that it's probably been pretty tough to follow after Mission Impossible 2, to continue to listen to this podcast, to continue this journey of watching all the Mission Impossible movies. But starting now with Mission Impossible
3, you get rewarded.
And moving on, it's going to continue to get better and better with Mission Impossible 4, Ghost Protocol. Least Important Things is a podcast about the most important of the least important things in pop culture and entertainment. You can be part of the show by leaving a voicemail at www.speakpipe.com/least important things or visiting our website at leastimportantthings.com and clicking the leave a voicemail button. You can email the show at leastimportantthings@gmail.com or reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Luke H. Ferris or Least Important Things on Facebook. Thanks for listening. And until next time, I'll talk to you soon.